Good afternoon, excuse me, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live as usual on weekday afternoons for an hour to take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and would like to raise those for discussion here. If you have a different viewpoint from that of the host, would like to balance comment, feel free to do that as well. All you'll need is a telephone and this number, and an opportunity to get onto the switchboard, which is there right now. We do have some lines open right now. You can call me here at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to be on the program today. Our first caller today is John calling from Corvallis, Oregon. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah.
We spoke last week, and just kind of introduced myself or reintroduced myself to the listeners. My name is John Perry. I'm not religious, but I'm not here to attack religion. That's not one of the things that I do. I am here to promote science, and the message that I have is that science is for everyone. It's for Christians, it's for Muslims, it's for atheists, and it's for Hindus. And that, I think you and I are on the same page with that. Last week, when we discussed a little bit about creation, you had said that you're under the impression that creation, the creation of life on Earth, was a supernatural event, which can't be properly explored through science. Is that a fair kind of summary of what you believe on that?
Yeah, I think it is.
My question is kind of a two-part question: is what does the word supernatural mean for you? And then, secondly, when witnessing a strange event like, I mean, the tornado that we just saw this week, how can we tell if it was caused by a supernatural force or merely by natural forces which we might not fully understand?
Well, a tornado, we know it's a natural event, and we know the natural laws that cause a tornado to occur. We might not be able to follow the string of events in, meteorology, going back as far as, things that happened days earlier or weeks earlier that may have contributed to it. For example, like a butterfly wing flapping in Japan. But we do know that when a tornado is occurring, we know that there's certain natural phenomena that are causing it, and they can be explained. If something can be explained naturally, then it at least has a natural explanation, obviously. But some things cannot be. The origin of consciousness, the origin of information, the origin of life are things that cannot be from non-life, consciousness. Those cannot be explained naturally.
There are actually some of those can, and some of those aren't. We haven't fully figured them out. But to say that something is supernatural and that it can't be explained is, in my opinion, that's not just not scientific. That's anti-scientific. That's saying this can't be explained. So stop.
No, it's not a scientific explanation, nor is it an anti-scientific explanation. It's a statement that comes from the assumption that not everything can be explained by science, by natural science. You see, natural science is a very limited field of inquiry. It has to do with things you can observe, things that you can repeat and predict, things that you can duplicate multiple times anytime you want to in a laboratory. There are many things that are outside the realm of science. For example, history. History is not part of scientific inquiry. It's we know about history because of historians writing it. We don't know it because we can go into a laboratory and test it. Many things about moods and feelings and choices that people make are not explicable in terms of laboratory experiments because people can't be predicted. Their actions cannot be predicted completely because of free choice. And therefore, there's psychology and there's history and there's science and there's theology, which explains many things that are beyond the realm of any of those fields. There's more than one discipline, in other words. But to say that the origin of life, lies outside the field of science. That's not an anti-scientific statement. It's not depriving science of its proper domain. It's just saying that not everything belongs to science domain.
Well, okay, so what does supernatural mean? That's kind of the question.
Okay.
In your
supernatural,
mind,
supernatural means it is not reducible to scientific or natural law. That it, you know, natural law is a predictable pattern of things and can be learned. And once you know the natural laws, you can predict what will happen when you do certain things. If you boil water at 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level, you can predict it's going to boil every time. That's because there's a scientific law involved there. But things that are not governed by scientific law are, or by natural law, I should say, are not natural. They're supernatural. Super means above or outside of nature. So whatever is outside of nature would be either subnatural or supernatural. Or some people use the term supranatural, but the point is it's a category other than nature. Nature, for example, cannot create itself. And so nature, I believe, was...
We can figure.
Right. And so I believe that, well... Nature, there are no laws of nature that would predict for anything creating itself, okay?
Not that we have right now. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, but we do have explanations that do not come from nature. And so there's no reason for us to say, well, we'll reject the supernatural explanations because we hope someday, it may not be our lifetime or our grandchildren's lifetime, we hope someday someone may figure out a natural explanation. Well, if they do, then that would be probably a good way to supplement or rule out the supernatural explanation. In the meantime, though, we have a very good supernatural explanation, which comes from a very good source, and that is from God. So why should we have a problem with that? Why should we insist that's not good enough?
So this is something that's really important to understand about when we're doing science. So, you know, as I mentioned, science is for everybody. It's for Christians, Muslims, atheists, Jews, everybody.
Right. There's no need to repeat that. No one disagrees with that. Right.
But when we're doing science, so we all have these different supernatural beliefs that we might bring to the table that we have in our personal lives. But when we do science, we're just discussing observations and how those observations can be best linked.
Exactly.
And so when a Christian comes into the laboratory, if he's suspicious that schizophrenia is caused by supernatural forces and can never be understood, when he steps into the scientific laboratory, if he's studying schizophrenia, he sets that belief aside and he assumes, at least for the moment, that this can be figured out. And it's that assumption, the ability to science assumes that all mysteries are solvable.
I know that, and this is why science is narrow-minded. You see, if we say, well, I may believe that schizophrenia has a personal, not a natural law explanation, but a personal explanation. That is, it's not caused by natural laws, it's caused by personal choices. Now, I may be right or wrong about that, but if I go into the laboratory intending and believing I can prove it in the laboratory, then I'm bringing into my studies something I don't have the right to bring in. I can go into the library and discover whether it has a natural explanation. But I can't go in there assuming that it does unless I have a certain bigotry against anything outside science. You see, a naturalist is a person who has decided there's nothing except nature. And therefore, of course, they are the ones who will assume that everything has a natural... They will assume that everything has a natural basis. Pardon?
I got to cut you off there. Someone who actually believes that everything has a natural explanation would be a true naturalist. A scientist doesn't have to be a true naturalist, but when a scientist is doing science, they step into the naturalist mindset. So you can believe in supernatural forces, you can believe in God, you can believe in all these different things.
Right.
But when you're doing science, you look for evidence. If you want it.
Well, right. When you're doing science, what I'm saying is not all inquiry is doing science. Not all inquiry is scientific inquiry. If I want to find out, when I was courting my wife, if I wanted to find out if she loved me or not, there was no laboratory in the world I could go into with you know, test tubes and beakers and so forth to figure that out. I would have to find that out from her behavior and from her her words about that. Okay, but that's not science.
You're observing her behavior, which is a scientific process.
No. That's a person. That's a relational process. See, you see, a scientist like yourself is a reductionist, and reductionism, if it can be justified, is fine. But if it can't be justified, then it's just bigotry to say, well, everything we do, every thought we think is a scientific inquiry. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. You'd have to somehow defend that position before I'll accept that. I learn from relationships, not from science.
Listen, before you go name-calling and calling me a bigot or calling science bigoted, that's...
Okay, I can call that if I want to. I didn't call you a bigot. I said it is bigotry to decide in advance that everything can be explained according to one set of paradigms when it can't be, and when there's no reason to believe that.
The only thing that a scientist assumes, well, there might be a couple things that you have to assume. There are at least two things you have to assume in order to do science. You have to assume that all of us share the same reality, because we're trying to explore reality together. So you have to assume that we all share the same reality. And secondly, you have to assume that all mysteries can be solved. This is an assumption. You don't have to believe that in your personal life. You're right, there are other lines of inquiry. But when you are doing science, those are the rules.
Okay, well, let me say something, John. I'm not here to do science, but I'm not uninterested in what scientists can produce. What I'm not interested in knowing is what a scientist like, say, Richard Dawkins, wants to tell me about things that are not in his field, like whether there's a God or not. See, that's a philosophical, not a scientific question. You can't even explore from science whether there's a God or not. Well, you can explore it, but the answer is not going to come from science.
You're right. From where we're standing right now, we can't explore whether or not there's a God. People haven't been able to demonstrate that. It might be possible someday. And actually, that's what the Discovery Institute seems to be doing. They're trying to find evidence that there is a God. But yeah, you're right.
What the Discovery Institute is trying to do, the Discovery Institute is trying to decide whether there's evidence of design or not. And, of course, if there is evidence for design, then there's got to be some explanation for that. And the God hypothesis would be, probably a very reasonable hypothesis. But they're not trying to prove that God exists. They're trying to demonstrate that there's evidence of design, which is something that, is a valid scientific question.
Yeah. Now, back to what you were saying with Richard Dawkins, I agree with you 100% that when Richard Dawkins is preaching atheism, he is not doing science. He is preaching atheism. And that is out of the realm of science. He takes off his science hat and he puts on this atheist hat and he's preaching atheism. And the issues that a lot of Christians have with science, there's this growing hatred of science. I mean, you just called science bigotry. I mean, that's obviously...
Excuse me. I did not call science. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm going to put you on hold, so I'm not going to let you lie about me like that without me and then talk over me while I try to clarify. I never said science is bigotry. And if that's the way you represent people you're talking to, you're going to have a hard time making an impression on people that's realistic or good, because I never said science. And I never said one bad thing about science. I said that if a person... Now, a person isn't science. A person is a personality, and maybe that's something that you're not differentiating. Science is not the same thing as the opinion of scientists, okay? Science is like mathematics. You can do it well, or you can do it poorly. Some things can be explained by science, and some things cannot, just like mathematics. You can do mathematics well, you can do mathematics poorly. You can explain some things by mathematics, and you can not explain other things by mathematics. It's the same kind of thing. Now, no one's ever going to criticize mathematics, but someone might criticize the way you're doing your sums. In fact, when I was in school, I got criticized a lot by my teacher by the way I did my math, because I was not very good at math, and some of the things I did had to be shown to be wrong. But that was my math teacher was not criticizing mathematics. He was criticizing the answers I was getting because I was doing math wrongly. Now, what I call bigotry is not science, But I said, if a person goes into the laboratory assuming that everything can be explained naturally, that's bigotry. Now, that's not science. If it was science, it wouldn't be bigotry. I'm talking about the fact that a person who is a scientist can be a bigot as well. And some of them are. And so are some Christians. There's lots of bigots. I'm simply identifying bigotry for what it is. When you prejudice yourself and say, I'm going to insist that this conclusion is correct before I explore it, that's bigotry. And that's what a scientist does. If he goes into the laboratory saying, I am assuming that everything can be figured out. Well, you haven't proven that yet, so you're going in there with an assumption, which is really what you should be going in there trying to prove. You don't go in there assuming you can explain it scientifically. You go in there to discover whether you can or not. If you go in already, then you're like, then you're like Dawkins. You know, a person says, well, there's nothing that can't be explained by science because there's nothing outside of nature. It's like Carl Sagan saying the cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, all there ever will be. That's a religious statement. It's a bigoted statement. He doesn't know that that's true. Nobody knows if that's true or not, but it's certainly not a scientific statement. But that is the kind of statement you have backing up the idea that I believe when I go into the laboratory, I can explain anything naturally. Why? Well, there's no reason to think that unless you think that nature is all there is. Because if there's things that are not in nature, then there's no reason to believe that everything can be explained naturally. Okay, you're back on.
Sorry, what's that?
You've got the mic.
The reason that science has this axiom, this assumption that all things can be explained, is because in the past, most things were assumed to be supernatural. Diseases, storms,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, so on.
True, many things were.
By assuming that they are not supernatural, by assuming that there is a logical explanation, by assuming they can be figured out, we have figured lots of stuff out. And so that's why
yes.
that assumption is made. You can be a Christian. I mean, you can even go in there assuming that maybe God might be discoverable through science. But you can be a Christian, you can have spiritual beliefs, you can have supernatural beliefs, but when you are doing science, you step in there assuming these things can be figured out. And that's essential for a scientist to do, because if you don't have that assumption, you just stop, you know?
That's not true. Most of the great pioneers of science, whether it was, Pasteur or Galileo or Copernicus or, the greats, Newton, none of these men assumed that everything could be explained scientifically. They all believed in God. They all believed in the supernatural, but they knew that many things could be explained supernaturally. Naturally. But they believe that other things were supernatural. So you don't need to be a good scientist. You don't have to assume that you can prove everything naturally. But you won't be a good scientist unless you think that some things can be proved to be natural. I think that's a good quest. Find out which things can and which things cannot. I believe what scientists have discovered now, though I don't think they'll acknowledge it in many cases, is that the spontaneous arising of life from non-life is one of the things that can't be explained naturally. And there's many good scientists, many of them who are not Christians, who have come out and said, that's basically, it's a category error to say that science can tell how life arose. Because life itself is not a physical phenomenon. It is sustained by physical organs, but it is not a physical thing itself. Life is something that belongs to another category. You can't put all the right chemicals in the test tube and send a charge through it and get really life.
Life is an emergent property. It is a real thing. It is not chemistry. It is an emergent property. You're right. There are people who say that life can't be explained through science, but once we explain it, they're going to have to stop saying that.
Well, I'm not going to put my money on them. Yeah, I'm not going to put money on them explaining it. I agree. Some people say, what we have, what the Christian has is a God of the gaps, right? You were talking about this, how that ancient people thought everything was supernatural, but now scientists have proven that a lot of things are not supernatural, and therefore probably nothing is supernatural. Probably everything can be proven to be natural. Well, that, to my mind, that's a science of the gaps, or an evolution of the gaps. I mean, there's many things that, for example, Dawkins would say, we have no idea how life emerged from non-life. But he's very confident that evolution will someday explain it. So he has an evolution of the gaps. He can't show that evolution can produce life. No one can show that. But he's got great faith in it. So he, in that gap, he sticks evolution. If a Christian says, well, I'm going to stick something more reasonable in there, I'm going to stick an intelligent being in there, then you could say, well, that's a God of the gaps. Okay, well, there are gaps. And you can stick evolution in the gaps, or you can stick God in the gaps. And I guess the question is, which one is a more reasonable assertion? That living organisms came from a living thing is much more reasonable. It actually fits what we know about science now.
One of the big differences between science and religion is that religion has a story start to finish as to how things happen, and science doesn't have that. And the reason for that is that as a scientist, just like as a child who's learning about the world around him, science is learning about the world around it, starting from where we are and branching outward. So we don't know what the future, way distant into the future, is going to be like. We don't know what the past, way far into the past, was like. But our knowledge is expanding in both directions. I mean, we can slightly predict weather patterns now, you know. We can slightly predict the future. We can slightly predict, by looking at the weather today, what it was probably like yesterday, even if we weren't there.
Right.
So our knowledge is growing in both directions. But you're right, there are gaps. There are many unknowns. There is uncertainty, which is what the scientist lives with. And it is their goal to try and learn more. That's what a scientist's goal is. And to say that some things are just unknowable is anti-scientific, because that defeats the entire purpose
of
science.
It's not true. Can you know every historical thing? Hey, let me ask John. Can you know every historical thing that's ever happened?
I cannot.
Okay, then it's unknowable.
It's
undiscoverable.
Not fundamentally unknowable.
It's undiscoverable. Okay, right. And God is God is not fundamentally unknowable, but he can't be discovered through scientific means. Neither can every historical fact be confirmed through scientific means. But that doesn't mean you can't know it if there's another source of information that isn't scientific, like, let's say, a historian. Let's say you find the journals of somebody who wrote about something that they saw and that happened to them. Well, you would never discover that through science, but you could still know it if you had a reliable source of information about it. So to say there are many things that we don't have such sources of information about, many historical events have gone by unrecorded, and they are by nature unknowable to us by any means. That's not an anti-scientific statement, because it's not a statement about science at all. It's not a statement about science. So to say that there are many things that will never be known by science or discovered by science is not an anti-scientific statement. It's saying there are limits to science, just like there are limits to other fields of study.
Okay, so what I'm hearing from this is that you're defining supernatural as things that are not fundamentally unknowable, but are unknowable to us because of our limitations. Would that be fair?
Well, I would say things that are supernatural are things that cannot subject themselves to a natural explanation. They might be knowable if someone lets us know them, or if we have experience with them. For example, let's take a phenomenon like demon possession, okay? I'm sure you don't believe in demon possession, but because if demon possession is true, then it's supernatural. Now, that doesn't mean we can't know that. Well, if a demon is a non-material being, a spirit with powers that are not subject to the laws of nature, and that's exactly what demons are believed to be by all persons who believe in them, then demon possession is a phenomenon that is not caused by natural causes, it's caused by supernatural causes. Now, can we know that? Well, we can't know it from science, certainly. But we could know it some other way.
Not right now. No.
Okay, well, let me just say this. Okay, John, we've been talking a long time, and I just have to say you have unbounded faith. I don't. In science. You see, if you say, well, I believe science will fill all the gaps for me someday, you're attributing to science a power that it has not demonstrated and does not promise to have. But you kind of stick it in there because you got nothing better to do. Well, I've got something better to stick in some of those spots, and that is that God has revealed himself. God has visited this planet. God has left a record of his doings and of much of what he has on his mind. You'll never discover those things from science. You can't discover God with litmus paper or a Geiger counter. God has to reveal himself because he's outside the realm of nature. But he can do that, and he has done that. So God is not unknowable. He's simply undiscoverable by science alone.
And is that because he's hiding himself on purpose from science, or...
Because science doesn't have the instruments to detect him. He's not made of molecules, okay? He's not made of molecules, and science will have no ability to detect something that is spiritual, because unless that spiritual thing is reduced to physicality, because that's what science studies nature. Science studies the physical world, and God isn't part of that. So it's not part of what it studies.
Okay, so there are many forces that science does not currently understand and cannot study, because we don't have the tools, like you said. But that's saying that we don't currently have a way to study it is different than saying that it's unknowable.
I didn't say it was unknowable. John, if you're going to dialogue with me, you're going to have to listen to me before you try to represent what I said. I try to measure my thoughts and say what I really mean. If somebody doesn't know what I said and doesn't listen, then they're not going to be able to answer me intelligently. You apparently are what I would call you're involved in scientism. There are scientists who are not into scientism. Scientism is a religion. It's a belief that science is the ultimate answer to all things because nature is all there is, and science studies nature. And there are things in nature that have not been discovered or explained yet, and science will someday explain them. I believe that's probably true. I believe that most things in nature that are truly natural will probably receive a scientific explanation and probably a valid one eventually. That we're far from that now, so it remains to be seen if that'll happen. But what I'm saying is that not everything is nature. There is stuff besides nature. There are beings besides nature. And science will never discover them because science doesn't study them. They're not in the realm that science studies. Okay? Now, if you say, well, I don't care what you say, everything's going to be explained by science, well, then you're simply saying, you say the same, you've got a science of the gaps. You say science will explain everything. I could say, well, God explains everything. And how is my position any less rational than yours? Actually, I think God has a lot more explanatory power than science does about a lot of things. And until someone gives me a reason to think otherwise, I think I'll stick with what I believe about that. But I appreciate your call, John, and you can call again sometime, but I've got other calls waiting. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to James from Las Vegas. James, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, I was outside watering my garden, and I was listening to your conversation with John.
Uh-huh.
And something from C.S. Lewis comes to my mind. Can I read that?
How long is it?
It's very, very short.
Okay, sure. Yeah, Lewis is always welcome here.
Okay. He says, God is the source of which all your reasoning power comes from. When you are arguing against God, you are arguing against the very power that makes you able to argue at all. It's like cutting off the branch that you are sitting on.
Mm-hmm. Now, see, some people would say that that's Lewis expressing a religious sentiment, but actually he reasons to that position philosophically, not religiously, because his position is that if naturalism is true, if all things can be explained by science alone, that means that the thoughts of my mind can be explained by science alone. If my thoughts are merely the result of neurons acting on natural laws, and there's no personality, controlling them or guiding them. It's just that my thoughts, whatever they may be, are random results of random occurrences of in the brain, you know, of the cells of the brain, an electrical, current and so forth in the brain. Well, then my thoughts it can't be thought to be necessarily transcendently valid. I could say The sun is not up, and you could say the sun is up. And the only reason I'm saying the sun's up is because the neurons in my brain are somehow making me think and say that, and the neurons in your brain are making you think and say something else, but one of us is wrong. In fact, we might both be wrong, because we can't trust anything in our perception if it's all just randomly caused by natural events. And so what he's saying is, when people rule out God, or at least something beyond nature, they are basically saying, you can't trust your thoughts. In fact, you can't trust mine either. So whatever I may say against God, or whatever I may say about anything, take it with a grain of salt, because it's worthless. It's just the result of the random firing of my neurons, and they're firing differently than yours. But who's to say that yours fire better or worse than mine? I like C.S. Lewis, and I think he makes a good point. Were you going to follow up on that?
No, I was just going to contribute that and let somebody else get on.
Okay, James, thanks for your call.
Oh, okay. Bye.
Good talking to you. Bye now. Mary from Salinas, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. A book that I'd highly recommend, since John has cited a couple of people to call, is Josh McDowell and Don Stewart's Reasons for Skeptics Should Consider Christianity. And science is a phenomenal subject. And one of the questions this book brought forth, I'd like to say a little couple sentences, if I may. It says, are the probabilities against the chance of formation of large biological molecules, what are the probabilities against the chance of formation of the large biological molecules? One of the most difficult problems facing those who accept naturalistic origins of life is the odds are against the chance of formation of even the most simple organic molecules.
Yeah, and all people who study genetics know that, too. I mean, that's why one of the greatest geneticists in America, Sir Francis Collins, is not an atheist. He's a Christian.
Yeah, take the simple one, Vasporum, which is in the pituitary gland. It only has eight molecules, but if they get out of order, it would not be formed correctly. And to just switch one of those two amino acids would destroy its function.
Okay. Well, I agree with that. I mean, I've certainly studied that out too, and it's just amazing, really, what would have to happen for life to emerge without direction from an intelligent being. You've got every living cell is made up of many hundreds of protein molecules. Each protein molecule is like a little complex robot that's specially designed to do a certain thing. Different proteins do different things and supply different purposes for the cell. These things have to not only all be present, but they have to be working together in such a way as to make an organism an organism. And that's even if it's just a cell. But those protein molecules are incredibly complex arrangements of amino acids. And they are chains of amino acids that are, there's like 22 amino acids, 21 amino acids, and they're like letters in an alphabet. And if you put them in the wrong order, they're gibberish. They're useless. If you put a box of Scrabble pieces, and you've got 100 Scrabble pieces, and you just throw them on the ground and have them be random, of course, it's gibberish. But if you have a mind that arranges them in a proper order, you can have a sensible sentence. Well, that's how the amino acids are. They have to be 100 amino acids of, 21 species of amino acids have to be arranged in a proper order for them to have any function at all. And when they do, then they form one protein. But the likelihood of even one protein being formed, randomly is like, I mean, scientists have compared it with all kinds of things.
13 to 1.
Yeah, 1 in 10 to the 13th or something. Well,
yes.
The point is the numbers are almost irrelevant. The fact is the numbers are astronomical. And frankly, when there's actually a very good explanation for where life came from, namely, where does life come from now? It comes from other life. Life doesn't come from non-life. Every living thing you know of came from another living thing. There's no evidence in science that any life can ever come from non-life. So, in other words, it's anti-scientific, at least according to every law of science known to man, to say that life could come from non-life. But we have an explanation that life didn't come from non-life. It came from a living source, a living being, an intelligent being. That fits all the facts. I mean, that fits all the facts, and it fits everything we know about science. I mean, it doesn't mean that the being is within science, but it means...
I agree with you, and I would really highly recommend this book.
Which book is it?
Thank you for your time.
Answers for Skeptics from Josh McDowell?
Yeah, Reasons Skeptics Should Consider Christianity.
Okay, Reasons That Skeptics Should Consider Christianity. Okay, thank you, Mary. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Steve, who's calling from somewhere in Oregon. Steve, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. I just wanted to throw out two quick comments. Going back to the call a little while ago, one thing is the way that they've tried to explain the chances of our universe coming together the way it is so astronomically, it's so amazing. It should never have happened. One way they explain it is they say that possibly there's more than one universe.
Right, multiverse.
Billions of them. But the problem with it is, they say, if there is more than one universe, we'll never know, because by definition...
It's not part of our universe. Right.
Don't touch. So it's something outside of nature, by definition, that's actually offered as an explanation, you know. So they're actually offering a supernatural explanation for life and for everything.
You've got a great point.
The other comment, real quick, is what C.S. Lewis said. He said, if I were to put 3 pennies in a drawer, and the next day I put 2 pennies in the drawer, but I count the pennies, and there's 6 pennies, it's because
somebody's been at the drawer.
The system messed with the drawer.
Yeah.
So that supernatural, just, it doesn't mean magic. It means outside of nature is all it means, not in the system we call nature. So God can be the guy outside the house that comes in and messes with the drawer. It's not that he's doing magic. It's just he's not part of the system that we experience as nature. Anyway,
right.
Okay,
thank you, Steve. I appreciate that. Yeah, a little more on those points. C.S. Lewis's illustration, he was talking to an atheist friend, and his friend was saying that science had proven there's no God. Now, of course, our caller, John, didn't say that. John's not saying that science has proven there's no God. But many people assume that is the case, and Lewis said, well, how could that be? And when Lewis said, you know, the laws of mathematics tell me that if I put 3 pennies in the drawer today, and then tomorrow I put 3 more pennies in the drawer, that there will be 6 pennies there. The laws of mathematics tell me that, but it may turn out that they won't be 6 because there may have been a thief at the drawer in between. So the fact that I put in 3 pennies today and 3 pennies yesterday doesn't mean it's going to add up to 6 pennies, because I don't know from the laws of mathematics whether or not someone's going to be stealing any of that. That it could happen. It's a part of reality, but it's not a part of reality that the laws of mathematics can tell me about. And the same is true of the laws of science. They can tell you about things that happen regularly if they are not interfered with. But the laws of science can't tell you whether there's something else that can interfere with them or not. That's not even something science can explore. Just like a mathematician can't explore whether there's going to be a criminal in my house or not. That's not a mathematics problem. And there are problems that are not science problems. Now, you're talking about the multiverse concept, and this is a really important thing, because this is what all the atheists want to talk about now, is the multiverse concept. Now, what they're doing, they're trying to deal with a serious problem that atheists have, which is what's called the fine-tuned universe. And even Anthony Flew, who was the leading atheist in America for 50 years, became a believer in some kind of God. He didn't become a Christian, but he became a deist. And in late in life, he was like one of the leading philosophers in America and wrote more books on atheism and was sort of the guiding light of the atheist movement. He became a believer in the existence of a God, and he did so partly, he said, because of the fine-tuning argument. I can't go into the details now, but many people are familiar with it, that there are things about the way our planet is positioned and our solar system is positioned and our galaxy is positioned and so forth that make it just totally the right place, you know, for life to exist. And the likelihood of having all these conditions by accident occur is just outrageously phenomenal. And no one really believes, no one would bet on a roulette wheel that had the odds against it that this has. And yet people still want to believe that it came by nature, by natural coincidence. So the answer is that the scientists are giving these days is, well, maybe this isn't the only universe. Maybe there's gazillions of universes out there, millions of universes, and they each have their own properties. And this one just happened to be the one that had this particular fortuitous set of circumstances that allowed life to arise. And, you know, they think that, in other words, the more universes you postulate and the more spheres there are where things could, conditions could be various ways, the more likelihood that one will be fortunate for life to emerge. But you see, they have to do this because they are acknowledging that in our universe alone, there's no way an intelligent person would think that, all these conditions would be right for life to emerge. That's their admission. That's what they're saying. That's why they say that there must be many universes. Now, of course, no one has any evidence for other universes, and they admit it. If there are other universes, we'll never know it because they are other universes, and science can only explore our universe. If there's other universes out there, like you said, it's supernatural. It's beyond our nature. And so they are admitting that nature alone in this universe cannot provide any conditions that would explain why life would arise here. So you need to have supernatural explanations, things outside of our universe. Now, they can't prove and never will be able to even test whether these multiverses exist. So why do they believe in them? It's not a scientific belief. The very first step of science is to observe something. And no one's ever observed a multiverse, and they admit that, in the nature of the case, they never will. So this is not a scientific statement. It's a religious statement. It's a faith statement. It's basically their way of saying, well, we admit that nature and the universe that's accessible to us cannot account for the rising of life. But if we have to put faith in something, we'll put faith in other universes that no one knows whether they exist or not before we'll put faith in God. So they've got a multiverse of the gaps. You know, it seems to me like the principle of Occam's razor, which says that the best explanation is one that doesn't require that you multiply entities unnecessarily, would choose the theist view over the atheist view, because we have to invoke something that can't be proven. We can either invoke an intelligent being that's entirely capable of bringing about all the things we see, or we can invoke billions and billions of universes that we hope might provide a milieu in which the things we see could have arisen. You know, I'll let the scientist believe what he wants to and the atheist believe what he wants to, but I'd rather believe the thing that's more reasonable. And as far as I'm concerned, what almost all human beings throughout history until modern times believed, because atheism is a very modern development. I mean, I'll go with the intuitions and the revelations that have come to the human race for the past thousands of years, rather than that which has only arisen in the last 300 or 400 years among people who want to be skeptical but don't have any explanation that works for them. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Steve. I didn't think I'd get through because I figured there'd be more people wanting to respond to the earlier caller. But I'm glad that I did get through. Anyway, I just wanted to say very quickly, so from a Buddhist perspective, one is relieved of having to say either way, a creator or no creator. Things just are, and whatever it is, and there's no need to try and assert some definitive position about its origin.
Well, there is definitely something that just is. You're right about that. There is something that is ultimate, something that has always existed. It's self-existent. It didn't have a beginning. It doesn't have to be explained because it was always there. The question is, what is that thing? And,
right. And
the question that would be relevant to the conversation I was having with John or with any atheist for that matter, and John didn't say he was an atheist. The question that's relevant is that thing, whatever it is that's ultimate, whatever that is, it's self-existent. Is it natural or is it not natural? Is it part of the physical universe or is it something else? Now, as a Buddhist, I would assume that your view would be it's Dharma, right?
Well,
and Dharma would be like the law that governs everything, and it's not a physical thing. Is that right?
Well, let me just back up a little bit. Natural and supernatural, those would both be labels. The fact that I exist, the fact that I, just using myself as an example, because obviously my life is very close to home, so the fact that I am here experiencing different sense impressions and different feelings and emotions and so forth, thoughts, that is the display in my subjective world. And if I label, you know, natural or supernatural, those are just that, just labels. The Dharma of experience or of life is what it is, apart from any label.
Okay.
So it would be a superimposition to, I mean, one could do that, but I wouldn't see much of a point other than maybe a convention.
Okay, but when you get back into the real world where things are physical, I mean, some things are physical and some things are not, it leaves unanswered the question of whether what was here first was physical or not. Like you said, it doesn't even deal with the question. It just says things are what they are. But see, that just basically says we're not going to inquire any further beyond our curiosity. And that's okay. If a person wants to go there, they can just say, okay, it's just as it is. But some people are more inquisitive than that. And they want to know, okay, was there a natural cause for all the things we see around us? Or is there no natural cause? Is there some supernatural cause? Now, as near as I can tell, the choice between theism and atheism hinges on that. If things can be explained without, any supernatural explanations, then it's reasonable to have just a naturalist view. But you see, to explain things without supernatural explanations is to rule out a great number of things that have been, we would say, revealed. Now, I don't know what, Buddha was said to be enlightened. Christians believe that God was revealed to us in Christ. Christ came down and revealed God to us. And God had revealed himself to Israel before that, in bringing them out of Egypt and giving them his laws and so forth. So we believe that the supernatural source of things has actually communicated with us. We actually believe we're not just guessing anymore. It's like getting a letter from someone overseas that you've never met. Someone could say, well, that letter is of natural causes, so, you know, that somehow just all the materials to make a letter just came together and found a postage stamp and your address appeared on the envelope somehow through natural causes, and now you've got this letter. It's easier just to say, well, this letter actually communicates rational information, and from my experience, written rational information only comes from people who have minds and are who are alive. So I'm going to go with the explanation that this letter and its information is not caused by natural law, but it's caused by a personality.
It's a reasonable inference that the whole manifest universe has an order and an intelligent design behind it. That's a totally reasonable inference. But from the perspective that I hang out with, the fact that anything is arising at all, that I can experience, I can hear your voice, that I can walk outside and see the trees and the birds and so forth, that is a miraculous arising in and of itself. I don't feel a particular need for an explanation as to its ultimate.
Okay, and there are people who are happy not to have those answers. There's other people, like I said, considerably more inquisitive, who would not be satisfied to have no answers about those things, especially if the answer can be explored. And, I don't know why anyone would not be interested in knowing the answers.
It's not a matter of not being interested. I don't see how it would be answerable, because if I said, all right, there is a God, but I wouldn't really know that. Again, it would just be an inference, so I can't know it directly. I can't know anything other than the actual display of what is presented before my field of senses, I can't really know anything ontologically beyond just that present experience.
Okay. Well, I mean, certainly we're going to find different people who are satisfied more easily or less easily with the information they have.
Yeah. There's many different views, many different ways of framing reality. The earlier caller obviously is looking at it from a scientific or empirical basis.
All right.
It was a great dialogue.
Hey, great. Well, I'm almost out of time, and I've got another caller to take, but I appreciate you weighing in.
Sure, Steve. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good day. Bye now. All right. We have an anonymous caller who wants to join us. Hello. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi. Thank you, Steve, for your honest answers. I just have a very quick comment about that John, who is trying to dig in a lot of stuff, and I think the more he's going to study, the more he's going to dig in, he's going to be more confused and confused, because God is bigger than what we even think. So no way he can study God or tell him to reveal to him, because God revealed himself, not the way we want it, the way he want pursue. And I have a very quick question. Corinthians chapter 3, verse 15. I don't know if you have a Bible with you there.
Mm-hmm.
You can take a look.
Okay, I'm turning there. We don't have much time. Okay, you're talking about Paul's statement that if anyone's work is burned, they'll suffer loss, but he himself will be saved? Okay.
Exactly.
Well, Paul is there talking about ministers of the gospel, and he's using the analogy of building a building. He's talking about, first of all, himself and Apollos. He says, I, Paul, laid the foundation, and others, like Apollos, come and build on the foundation. Of what? Of the church. He said the church is God's building in verse 9. And so the church is seen as the metaphor of a building under construction. Paul started the building in Corinth by laying the foundation. He got there first and preached the gospel. Others, like Apollos, came afterwards and built on the foundation Paul laid. And he goes into saying, well, people who build on it should be careful not to build badly or with wrong materials, because they're going to be judged by it. And if they don't build with good materials, for example, if they build with wood, hay, and stubble, then everything they've built is going to be destroyed, although they themselves may be saved, but they may get to heaven without any reward for what they've built. But if they build with the right materials, with gold and silver and precious stones, then the fiery test will only purify them, that will not destroy them, and they'll have a reward. So Paul's talking about the rewards of different people's contribution to the ministry of building up the church. In the verses just before that, before verse 9, he talks about how the church is God's field. And he says that Paul planted the seeds in the field, just like he laid the foundation of the building. And Apollos watered those seeds, just like Apollos builds on that foundation. And he says, but God gives the increase. But he said the laborers, each is going to receive his own reward for his work. So his context is talking about different ministers and the work they do in building the church or in cultivating the field, which is the church, and each one getting his reward. But the man who builds with wood, hay, and stubble, and his works are burned up, but he himself is saved, is a picture of a man who's a Christian, and he's doing ministry, but he's not doing a good job building the church. He's building with the wrong materials. Probably since the church is built out of people, and Peter says living stones elsewhere in 1 Peter 2:5, Paul's probably thinking of building the church with the wrong kind of people. That is building a big church with people who aren't really Christians or aren't really committed Christians. You can build a wood, hay, and stubble structure if you want to, but it's not going to stand the tests of hardship and trial because they're not real Christians. But real Christians are compared with gold and silver and precious stones in Scripture, and they do endure the trials. So Paul, I think, is saying that those who build on the church should not cater and should not preach a message that will attract people who don't have any real commitment, aren't really Christians, but should build the church with the real stuff. We're out of time. My music didn't play when I thought it should, so I'm going to have to just jump off here. Have a good day. Bye now.